Hello, all of you wonderful members out there, and welcome to this Relocated for Today live session. We're coming to you from Balnarring, Charles and I. We're here on a family weekend away. Don't worry, it's under 10 people here at Balnarring with my family, which has been an enjoyable time so far.
It has. Lovely to be here.
And Charles has just finished recording his podcast and YouTube podcast, and so the afternoon will be spent promoting those and editing those. But we've already been hard at work, and earlier today you were out there bike riding.
I rode to Arthur's Seat from Balnarring, and it was like that. So it's 20Ks, and I'm a good rider. It took me an hour to go up, 35 minutes to come down. And as I started riding, I couldn't remember it was such a climb to the top of Arthur's Seat from Balnarring, which is at sea level. And I'm thinking, gosh, I'm tired. And then when I got to the top of Arthur's Seat, when I came down, now I realised I was going uphill all the way. Anyway, it was a hard workout, but it was good.
I wasn't doing as much hard work. I was having breakfast and reading a book in the sunshine. So I'm just going to go straight to screen share, just so we can go to the Trello board as usual. And we're going to today's live session. The first thing I wanted just to remind you about is what our daily focus has been this past week and will be through to Wednesday next week. And that is, what is the good and the bad of working at your practice? To ask yourselves these questions as a team. And if you, per team member, go through each of them and say, what do you really love working about working here? And what elements would you love to see improved upon? Then you'll start getting a better snapshot of what the experience of your team members is like. And we've been speaking quite a bit over the last couple of live sessions about absenteeism, what we can do as a team to reduce down absenteeism when it's happening, when it's not particularly because of illness that people aren't turning up. One of the reasons people don't turn up is because they've been disengaged or they're feeling heavily scrutinized or bullied in some way in the workplace. And so creating a magnificent team environment is going to reduce down the chances of absenteeism when it's not illness as a reason in your practice. And this question can help you get to that space. So you'll continue receiving the emails in the morning, every morning until Wednesday next week, about what is the good and the bad of working at your practice. So, as you know, a special event today, we've got Charles Coves here as our special guest, speaking about confident communication with patients to achieve great outcomes. Let's tick off that that's done. I'm going to stop sharing so we can just speak square on to Charles. So, Charles, what I've experienced and many dental practices have experienced, that depending on the level of confidence and experience and wisdom that the dentist has, they can struggle in their early days with the rejection, in essence, that patients deliver to them, or negative response that is delivered to them when a treatment suggestion or treatment plan has been proposed. And I would like to speak more about that and hear you speak more about that, because there are things that we can do as younger people in the industry to help fast track us down that path of confident communication with patients.
Well, Julie, you are certainly a confident communicator. And I think it's fair to say that I'm a confident communicator.
I'd say so.
So from a dentist perspective, I want you to think about what it means to be confident. First of all, confidence. What is confidence? What is self-confidence? I'm confident that I could ride to Arthur's Seat today. That means... What does that actually mean? I'm confident that I can make the dinner tonight. I'm confident that I know the way to drive to somewhere. I'm confident. Okay, so confidence is tied into belief. You know, belief in ourselves, self-confidence. And this is a very nuanced thing as to why we're not confident in particular environments, why we are confident, and it ties into skill. There's a beautiful picture that I've got. I wish I had it here. We'll post it on the Trello board if I can find it. It's of a six-month-old baby underwater, eyes wide open, 6 months old, and the quote beside it is, everything is difficult before it's easy. So when you come to this question of confidence, I've been riding my bike in triathlons, competing in triathlons for 35 years. Your skill set, you're confident in communications, you're part of Toastmasters. So, yeah. So perhaps that's one of the things that we might take on as an idea, you know, that you, young dentists should join Toastmasters to get confidence in the spoken word. Now, I've been a professional speaker for 27 years. Before that, I was a lawyer. So when at the age of 7, I was on the stage doing Hungarian shows. So I was always confident. Now, that also meant that I believed that I wouldn't make a huge mistake. I also believed, when I think back it, that if I made a mistake, no one would shoot me. So that I was not terrified, and so I was willing to have a go. And then that willingness to have a go also tied in what I believe about myself. And so if you want to be confident in things, start to look into what you believe about yourself. Now, here's dentists, older dentists as well, in coaching them in terms of their discomfort in presenting, their discomfort in going to social functions.
Yeah.
You know, like a cocktail party. And so they're scared to go to a cocktail party by themselves. So let's focus on the cocktail party. When you're walking, it's a scary cocktail party in your mind that you could go to. And then you start to go, what? So what's scary about a cocktail party? And one of the issues that crops up for us about ourselves is that we are acutely conscious. I'm coming back to the belief about ourselves. We say, I believe I'm a good dentist, but I really don't know much about anything else. Then is, I don't know much. And so going into a cocktail party, not much. Now, the metaphor that I use for this is that if between my hands is the sum total of human experience, of all of the knowledge that there is to know, the smartest person on the planet would know this much of this. And so the idea I want you to embrace is that every single person that you meet at a cocktail party knows less than that, knows this much, just like you. Each one of us knows a tiny amount of what there is to know. And so you walk into an environment and the conversation that you have with yourself is, I know a little bit, everyone here knows a little bit, no one here knows everything. And therefore, you don't have to worry when somebody says to you, Julie, what do you think about the economy? It's entirely okay to say, what would you say?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
Defer to my husband.
What do you think about the level of debt that Australia has? What do you think? So that's the first thing. So become confident, become practiced. You see, confidence comes from practice. So become confident in the principle, in the practice of saying, I don't know.
No.
And there's a wonderful book by Anthony DeMello called Awareness. And it's a beautiful book on personal development, on spiritual development. And my dad gave that to me many, many years ago, and it's really in a thinking way. And in it, DeMello says, we each know such a tiny amount. Each one of us is just an idiot. And if somebody says something to you, say, I don't know, and the person says to you, you must be an idiot. So I am an idiot. Except for dentistry, I'm an idiot. Except for these topics, I am an idiot. So what are you an idiot in? No. What is there that you know nothing about? Oh, okay. Well, you're an idiot in that. That's great. We are all, each one of us is an idiot. Nice about accepting that we're idiots for most parts of knowledge is that we don't beat ourselves up, because it's the beating ourselves up that leads to a drop in confidence, because we say, I'm no good, I don't know enough, I can't impress people, I can't, people won't want to deal with me because I'm not smart enough. So confidence comes from a belief that you can do something. Confidence comes from being willing to practice skills. So I get my confidence through practicing certain things. And because I accept that I'm an idiot in most things, I'm therefore willing to keep practicing. Now, let me give you a case in point as a dentist. How long does it take for you to be confident in doing a filling perfectly? You've been in the dental space for a long time.
Yeah, and I don't think I've ever come across a dentist that would confidently say, I can confidently do fillings. That's the best way you can do a filling, because there are new techniques and new materials and more experience always to be had.
So this idea, in my podcast today, it's ironic, it was all about mistakes. Yeah. You cannot get better at anything unless you make mistakes. Now, we lose confidence because we might make mistakes. And when you adopt this philosophy that mistakes are good because that means that I'm learning, then you go into any new environment willing to make mistakes, because the worst thing that's going to happen is someone's going to think you're an idiot. And that's happened to me plenty of times, and I'm used to that, even though I don't like thinking I'm an idiot. But, you know, my nephew probably thinks I'm an idiot, but that's okay too. But then you say, but I don't have to know everything. I don't have to know about everything. And secondly, because I know I have to make mistakes to get better at something, then I'm not going to consider myself a failure that I made the mistake.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Now, this ties into treatment plans. I'm setting up your thinking. So why aren't I confident? I often say to parents of teenagers, when they say to me, my children aren't confident. You need to be able to handle that. And you need, you know, you say, well, how do you get confidence? The answer I give to parents of teenagers is exactly what I'm sharing with you. That teenagers lose their confidence because they're terrified of being excluded from the game. They're terrified of rejection. And school can be a very harmful place, but so also the gangs. Have a look at the gang warfare that's going on in Melbourne, in cities, you know, where people, they want to be part of the, you know, their life is over. Or if people criticize them, troll them on social media, they're committing suicide. Now, you wouldn't commit suicide if you had high self-confidence, would you? And so the school journey is very devastating for a lot of people. And you know, the fact that you're a dentist is generally an indication that you were pretty good in school. But you see, school is a very controlled environment. And I did well in school, but Julie, you didn't.
No.
You told me. No, we've got family walking through, but it's okay.
we're on route to bathrooms and bedrooms and everything. But that's right. In school, I certainly wasn't a confident student. And I certainly found that the subjects that I didn't do well in, all the tests that I didn't do well in, with every time my confidence dropped, I would be less inclined to try hard. I would be less inclined to study, because why set myself up for failure? Failure was okay in that sort of situation, I imagine. I'm just thinking this now.
But no one helped you with you're thinking about
that. As a student, I'm just recalling back that if I didn't try and I didn't study and I failed, then that's because I didn't try and didn't study. It wasn't because I was a failure. And so I suppose that I stepped into a safe world where I wasn't really trying too hard. And so then I could have a lower expectation of myself.
That's correct. You said to yourself, it doesn't matter. Mm. So I'm not going to try. So the score doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that then fed on itself. But as a person, my sense is that you were a confident person at school.
Yes, I must have been, I think, because I left, or I was encouraged to leave school at the end of year 10. So
midway through year 11?
Yeah, I started year 11. Right. I started year 11. And then I...
Lucky for you, dentist, yeah, that she did.
That's that nice. Was the job. You either become a hairdresser as a high school dropout, or you become a dentist.
So the kids who do well in a structured school environment, namely you as dentists, you did well in that. You memorized, you were good at memorizing stuff. You did the science, what's what are we calling it now? Science, maths, tech, anyway, the STEM. That's right, STEM. Science, technology, and maths. Okay, so people with a particular mindset can do well at school. And so the kids who don't do well at school, how do they feel about themselves? They feel bad. And therefore, because they're feeling bad about themselves, the gang or the group of people that they mix with, they don't want to mix with them. What? No one wants to mix with people who are down in the dumps. Mm-hmm. And that's, by the way, that's a clue. If you haven't found the love of your life yet, one of the keys is to be confident. People are not drawn to people who don't exude a certain amount of confidence.
For sure.
So this whole principle about confident communications with patients also applies to your whole life and to your children. And so the way that you build confidence is to help teenagers, help anybody understand what they're good at this much out of all of this. And then when they get that as a principle, then it becomes much more believable to say you don't have to be good at everything.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be good at everything. I just go, no, I'm an idiot. Right? So
I imagine there's dentists out there saying, yes, my area of expertise and my knowledge and what I'm confident in is dentistry. However, the bits that I'm not confident in is that communication with patients. I find that troubling. I'm not naturally a people person, or I am a people person, but I'm not used to that space of trying to lead somebody to a decision that's going to help that patient be healthier.
So, but I thought you were going to head down another way, but that's okay. We'll get back to this because it's easy to say, I'm good at this in dentistry, but I don't do that. I'm not a specialist.
Yes, that's true.
Or I love doing fillings, but I don't want to do extractions. Mm. What else? Give me some more examples of where dentists are happy to say, I'm no good at that.
Root canal fillings is one of those things, and certainly oral surgery is one of those things. It's just not something I do. I always refer out to a specialist.
That's it. I don't want to do that. So let that be your reminder that you, even within dentistry, you don't have to be good at everything. Coming back to confident communications with patients, the greatest blocks to selling an idea is fear of rejection, fear of failure. Those two, please write them down. Excuse me. Fear of rejection, fear of failure. Now, you might say, I'm not a good salesman. Julie says she's not a good salesperson, saleswoman. And I don't like selling anybody anything. But my favorite definition of selling is this. Selling is simply the transfer of enthusiasm for something from one person to another. The transfer of enthusiasm from me to you about something. That's a much better idea.
Oh, sure.
Now, Julie, are you enthusiastic about the club?
I'm incredibly enthusiastic about the club. And when I've been putting together these emails that some of you may have been receiving, promoting the club to the broader market, those who aren't a member yet, I do have that struggle. I want to tell them the key concept of it, and I do want to transfer that level of enthusiasm, but there is certainly something inside. And I don't know if it would be a fear of rejection, but what if I do articulate very effectively the benefits as I see them and the features of the club, and they still say, no, not for me. That's a fear of rejection for sure. Yeah. Mm.
And so each one of us has to understand what our feelings are.
Okay, this is part two. Internet is unstable here at Balnarring in Victoria. And so we were starting to talk about the rejection in terms of how it affects our confident communication with patients.
And we were talking about enthusiasm for a treatment plan. Never try to get a patient to engage in a treatment plan if you personally are not enthusiastic about it. If you are working in the environment where you are forced to impose treatment plans on somebody that is not good for that person, leave that practice. Whatever you do, that will destroy your confidence entirely. Do not be in an environment where the values of the practice are contrary to your own. And if you're not enthusiastic about it, then you know I urge you to take that decision. You say, I can't afford to. Yes, you can. The price you pay for trying to sell somebody on something that's bad with value to them, that's bad. Now, that's number one. So are you enthusiastic about the treatment plan? And if you're not, why not? What's wrong with the treatment plan? Yeah. Now, we'll come to value and price in a moment, because this is where the confidence happens as well. So the starting point is to believe that you can be fantastic at selling when you simply look at this idea of transferring enthusiasm. Let me tell you a story. You are at the supermarket and you have your five-year-old daughter or niece or son or nephew, you know. But I'm going to be politically incorrect and say, as a matter of science, there are scientifically males and females, and you can choose to behave otherwise, but I reject the nonsense that there's 100 different genders. Forget it. Now, so you're at the supermarket with your five-year-old, and it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon at the checkout counter. And the five-year-old says to you, Mummy, Auntie, Daddy, I want a chocolate bar. And you say, you can't have one. And the five-year-old says, okay. I don't think so. What does a five-year-old do?
What's he the can scream and
No. Think about this.
Okay.
What's the first thing a five-year-old now? Since Julie's a stepmother of five and I'm a father of five,
I haven't had direct
The five-year-old says, oh, Julie, can I have a chocolate bar? No, because it's dinner time in an hour. It'll wreck your appetite. I'll go on. Look, I'll eat that. No. Please, can I have a chocolate bar? No. I'll clean my room when I get back. No. Why can't I have a chocolate bar? Because it'll wreck your appetite. I don't care. I want a chocolate bar. And it builds up to a tantrum. And then you hit the child, and now suddenly you're in trouble with the law. I used to. Well, I didn't bash them up. I wasn't a basher of kids, but we are born, so the five, do you think the five-year-old is enthusiastic about the chocolate bar?
Very much so.
Very, okay. You were born with this ability to say, I'm enthusiastic, I want this. I'm enthusiastic about this chocolate bar. I'm using the word enthusiasm, but you know, we are born to be able to manipulate adults, negotiate with adults. And so part of the message today is remember your natural capabilities. So what happens is you go to school, and this confidence that we have as 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds to get what we want, we lose it because we get to school, you have to behave. Now, that's what the system wants you to believe, that you need to follow the rules.
Yeah.
But when you're a kid, you don't know that. That's why kids are so good at learning computer games. Mm-hmm. And so you are born able to do this. So remember. Now, we talked about skills, okay? So confidence in skills. So what we're covering here today, you have to practice what I'm talking about. This is not a become good. And I'm working with Julie to get Julie better at transferring.
My enthusiasm.
Your enthusiasm for the club. That's what you have to learn to do.
Yeah.
This is worth
doing. And that one concept is enormously helpful. Just that one concept of transferring enthusiasm. It's wonderful. I'm not trying to convince someone to do something that's not good for them. Yep. I'm not trying to push them into something that they can't do, wouldn't do naturally.
Yep.
I'm just transferring my enthusiasm around what I know to be a good and useful product to them.
Yes, good and useful. Not useful, but hugely useful.
And it's easy, sorry to interrupt, it's easy to become enthusiastic about what you're offering patients. Because as we've said before, from words from Sandy Roth, that you everything that you're doing is trying to help the patient look better, feel better, function better, and have greater peace of mind. Of course, that's going to be something that you're enthusiastic about. That's something that they're going to be enthusiastic about as well, if you articulate it.
That's correct. If you articulate it well. Now, that's what you have to practice, particularly as a younger dentist. I urge you to start writing scripts. Mm-hmm. Write your script for how you're going to transfer enthusiasm. What's going to be the order of your presentation of the treatment plan? What are you going to say first? What are you going to say second? How are you going to say that? Now, I have been a professional speaker for 27 years. I'm constantly honing the way that I share my ideas around messages because I want to make things, to quote Albert Einstein, as simple as possible, but no simpler. Now, if a patient is confused, they're not going to buy. And so this decision that you make yourself is, good, I'm going to learn how to communicate treatment plans.
Because that confusion is a given. You are speaking about concepts and engineering principles and technologies that the patients have widely no idea about and no basis of information or comparison to anything else as well. And so I think that transfer of information, I have heard some dentists in the past compare, you know, facing a veneer over the tooth is like putting siding over the side of the house. So you equate it to things that people can have a direct relevance to so they can understand it more effectively.
Very good. Learning is linking what you know to the unknown. So metaphors, analogies, that's great. Veneers are like putting a new covering on your weatherboard house.
Yeah. But so confusion is something you've got to battle through.
Confusion kills engagement. That's the other principle. So your job when you're presenting a treatment plan is zero confusion in the patient. Now, you're going to develop, and I'm not having the time to go through what the order is of presenting the treatment plan, but you in your, in fact, that's another topic that we could do in terms of the order in which to just address the elements of a treatment plan leading to yes.
Right.
And we've done some work on that in the past, but that's worth going through. But we're talking about confident communications here. Mm-hmm. We're now talking about the system, because if you develop the system, guess what happens? you become confident that you can develop the system. Doing a filling is systematic. Your presentation of a treatment plan needs to be just as scientific and systematic as a filling. Mm-hmm. Now, there is art involved in the filling, isn't there?
For sure.
So there is art involved in presenting a treatment plan, but you set up the system and the process, and then depending on who the patient is, you can play around with it, but you've got a systematic way to address it. Mm. And remember, everything's difficult before it's easy. Mm. So you go, okay, I'm going to get enthusiastic about this plan, good, I'm going to have a system, good, I'm going to practice this, and I'm going to write out my script of this process.
And we certainly did speak about, at the last live session, Norbert Orbison's Anatomy of Persuasion, that book that told me how to, the journey, the buying journey the patient has to go on, because quite often what we're doing is, as dental professionals, is telling a patient what they need rather than that patient recognising it's a need that they want a solution for. And so that takes them from need, so we're diagnosing and telling them ramifications if we just left this to its own devices, and then recognition, and that's when the patient recognises, yes, it's a need, but I also now want to act on that need and search for a solution. And then we go through search, that's when we've set the patient up, and we go through all of the different services that will address that person's oral condition. Evaluation, help them identify all of these benefits and drawbacks to each of these solutions, which one is going to best address my need. And sometimes the final decision, which is the final phase of this, is I'll go with A, B, or I'm going to do nothing because I have no funds to pay for it, or for whatever reason that the patient may have. Mm. But each of those stages has in itself the script. And when you know what to say, and when you say it time and time and time again, and you've got your team as part of that system, absolutely, I can see that's where the confidence really comes in.
Yes. So whilst you're talking about benefits and drawbacks, I was then going to touch on, from the patient's perspective, the pleasure-pain equation. So benefits and drawbacks is one element, but people make decisions, people are motivated, by pleasure and pain. Now, you also mentioned what patients need and want. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope in other sessions you've talked about this. What do people do? Do people do what they need to do? Mm-hmm. Or do they do what they want to do?
What they want to do, which is why I didn't go bike riding this morning.
That's it. And I finished with a cold shower and a cold morning this morning, and it was cold. I didn't want to do it. Sorry. I didn't need to do it either. I chose. Now, want versus need. So people do what they want to do, not what they need to do. Mm. Have a look at, that's why 65% of Australians are overweight or obese. Mm-hmm. They need to lose weight. They don't want to lose weight. They like to lose weight, but they don't want to. So there are some things that we need to do. We don't want to do it, but we still do it. What are those circumstances? Mm. If we do what we need to do, the answer is, if we've got a toothache, we will scrounge for the money to solve the toothache, won't we?
For sure.
When there's sufficient pain, we do what we need, contrary to what we want, but most people do what they want. And this is another reason. Another example is doing your tax return. You need to do that. Who wants to do a tax return? Who wants to pay money to the government?
Who wants to do?
Okay. So understanding that syndrome. So the patient then will accept the treatment plan based on a pleasure-pain equation. Okay. Do I want this treatment plan? Do I need this treatment plan? And, you know, I would say to you as a long-term investor in dental wealth, by the number of fillings I have in my mouth, mercury fillings. By the way, I have a very stable set of teeth. Quite remarkable.
We've been together for a long time and really haven't been.
We're doing a live demonstration here, darling. How many?
Look, you can imagine, like every molar tooth, just about every premolar. Yeah.
What do you reckon, a month, 32 teeth? How many? Like, I've had work. And And I've got all my teeth. I don't have one. I'm nearly 68 years of age. Pretty solid, pretty stable, isn't it?
Yeah.
And by the way, let me share this thought with you, because Julie might not have. Up until I fell in love with Julie, I thought, I don't know why, but in my mind, my teeth were just almost like a solid piece of ceramic. That was the picture in my mind. None of these living, incredibly complex piece of machinery. And I'm not stupid, but I was really surprised at my picture of teeth in my mind.
And I think that's a nice observation to throw in here, just to help everyone understand how little the general population do know about their teeth. And there was an SBS documentary, Fill the Gap, I think it was called, and had members of the audience speaking about their challenge in getting dental treatment done when there's, you know, it's an expensive part of maintenance of health, that's for sure. And there's also little government subsidy around that as well, unless you're in specific groups. And the people's stories were very much a complete unawareness, and they felt like they were thrown into this world where they were, the only way they could get to any kind of oral health was from, is by getting this hugely expensive, traumatic thing done. Otherwise, the other option is just to do nothing and just to continue to have this erosion of their oral condition. And it really helped me think, gosh, every dentist has to watch this to remind themselves how little patients really do understand.
Yeah.
Even though, as we've mentioned in the past in live sessions, the patients will nod politely like they understand everything you've said, and they walk out and they have no idea.
So the question is, so I would put that on the Trello board, that's something worth watching. And the other picture that really struck a chord with me was the nerves inside a tooth that you've often shown me.
Yeah.
Of a root canal, I thought, there's only three little canals. No, there's hundreds of nerves going through that. And so when a patient sees that, it helps them understand what we're talking about, what you're talking about, not me, you. The other issue is, so there's the pleasure-pain equation. What's the pleasure of this treatment plan? What's the pain of this treatment plan? And one way that you can describe that is write down, and I would start to collect these in the feedback sessions, in the question, what is the pleasure of saying yes to your treatment plan? And all of the possible benefits of the yes, okay? And then look at the pain. What is the pain of undertaking this treatment plan?
And those two lists are easy to identify. All you need to do is use those four areas that we mentioned before. How is this going to make a patient look better, feel better, function better, have greater peace of mind? Or if there is no treatment done on that area, what are the ramifications? How will it make them feel worse, function less well, have less peace of mind, and not look as good?
And the fifth element, all of those four will then lead to that patient's confidence. Mm. Okay, so their income earning ability. Now, I've worked with some orthodontists on this. This is a very extensive, it's much a longer list than we're talking about, of the pain of not doing this, so that this could impact, you know, on how you smile, how you look in interviews, your chance of getting a better job, chance of getting better income. And so the mere fact that your treatment plan costs you $20,000, you can demonstrate that in 5 years' time, you're probably wasting $100,000 by trying to save $20,000.
Mm.
And so all the time, as doing your tax return, we do what we don't want to do, we need to do, because we don't want the tax fine, okay?
Yeah.
And so we don't want to do the treatment plan because it costs money. But when your job, why you're enthusiastic about the treatment plan is because you know the patient's life is going to be better in all of these possible ways. Mm. And so understanding that psychology helps you in preparing your script. Now, the other question is, in what environment do you present the treatment plan?
Yeah, and it's usually inside a surgery, unless you've got the luck of having an environment that's large enough that you can actually have a patient discussion room. And a lot of modern practices make sure they have that incorporated in the floor plan, because we all understand how important that is in terms of getting a patient properly engaged. Mm. But usually it is inside the surgery itself.
Well, if you're in the surgery, having the patient in the chair, I think is not a good strategy, because the patient feels vulnerable. So I think I would contemplate getting two small bar stools, and you move from the patient's chair. So right, let's talk about this, and you get them on similar level, because remember, this patient is totally vulnerable in the dental environment. Remember, we know this much, you as a dentist know this much, but the patient, he could be a total superstar in the area of landscape gardening, or in the area of being a chef, okay? Mm-hmm. But he knows nothing about dentistry. So part of coming to the high chairs is to be able to be looking at the same level, yep. Not looking down.
Yep.
So psychologically, that's an issue.
And we certainly have set her, lovely sister. She's had a knee operation. She's hobbling around. We're calling her Hop Along.
Hobble along.
That's right. But we have certainly mentioned in the past that you must be at eye level with the patient. You cannot hold a lengthy discussion with the patient if the patient's having to turn their head to face you. So if they're sitting in the chair and you're sitting beside them, that's not good enough either. They will be thinking more about their sore neck rather than their tightening neck, rather than what you're saying. And so I think Charles is right. It would be very easy in many surgeries to get two little bar stools, but you can even have those tables that are on hinges that can fold up against the wall while you're doing all your treatments.
Yep.
And then it folds up a little prop that you can sit there and engage the patient. But even if you didn't have a table there, nowadays there's whiteboards and iPads and all sorts of aids that you can just support between the two of you and have a good engaging discussion.
And because we're talking about a treatment plan that could be $5,000, $6,000, $10,000, $20,000, you can have this bar stool outside the surgery. Okay, so that if you're going to sit down in the surgery to do that, then you bring the bar stool in. So it's not in your way while you're doing a thing. So, you know, this is a 1 minute exercise to set this up for a human to human conversation. Now, let's talk about value. Right, so one of the things that your skill in being confident about your communication is that you get the patient to want what the patient needs. That's the genius of the skill that you're going to develop. The patient doesn't want a treatment plan, but the patient needs a treatment plan. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah.
And you know as a dentist that this patient needs the treatment plan. That's why you're enthusiastic about it, okay? So your job now is to shift the patient in their consciousness that they want what they need. So come back to the overweight situation. People need to lose weight. They don't want to lose weight. But when they go to the doctor and the doctor says, if you don't lose weight, you're going to die. And suddenly, the need becomes a want. I want to lose weight. And you know, Anthony Robbins, who I'm a big fan of, gives a beautiful story of a person who couldn't give up smoking cigarettes. And his 10-year-old daughter comes in and sees him smoking, and she bursts into tears. And father says, darling, what's up? She says, I'm so upset, Daddy, that you're smoking, that you're going to die before you can come to my wedding. Makes me cry. And, you know, and that was the why. If the why is big enough, you can do anything if the why is big enough. And so similarly with the presentation of the treatment plan. You need this. Yeah, but I don't want it. Good, let me tell you. So I now want to get to value. I have made the mistake many times by making the assumption that a person can't afford to buy what I want them to buy. I make that, you know, that's a mistake that I've made in the past. You do not know whether a person can or can't afford it. They will tell you they can't afford it. Okay, they will tell you that. But in the meantime, they're spending $200 a week on alcohol.
Yeah.
Or cigarettes, but they say they can't afford it. Now, value. What is value? So the first step is you want to shift the patient to want what they need. And then the question is, are we adding value to the patient's life? And when I ask professionals this question, what's the test for adding value? And the answer is the price that I'm charging less than the value that they're experiencing? So as a former lawyer that I used to be, Julie, as you know, I say to the lawyer, how do you know you're adding value? Well, if you have to pay me $5,000 to recover a debt of $50,000, you're $45,000 better off, aren't you?
Yes.
I've added value. If you pay me a dollar, I get you $1.20. Mm-hmm. You have 20 cents added value. Now, if the patient, if you've got a treatment plan, what would be an expensive treatment plan?
An average expense, maybe 40,000.
What would be a medium treatment plan?
Anything more than just the next coming singular treatment, maybe 3,000.
So up to 40,000, good. So 40,000, 10,000, in my mind, 20,000 plus is a serious investment. If you go to an orthodontist, what's the?
Less, like that would be around $4,000 or $5,000.
For one treatment?
For a two-year treatment.
Okay, so the point is, how do you figure value? And this is where your confident communications comes, because you go, my treatment plan is $20,000. I've got $20,000 in my head.
Yeah, nice, good figure.
You know, if you take into account the pleasure pain of that, it's painful to hand over $20,000 after tax. Mm-hmm. If you borrow $20,000 today on all these, it's going to cost the $20,000 a tiny amount each week. Now, one of your jobs is to demonstrate the value. If you don't do this treatment plan, here's the financial implications for you, okay? Mm-hmm. And one of them, in my mind, is me feeling good about me and the rest of my life. When I feel good, I perform well, I earn more money. So $20,000, you know, is a small amount of money over the course of the next 10 years, and a treatment plan could impact on how many years, 20 years? Mm-hmm. Quite easily. We're talking at $1,000 a year, and the person says, I can't afford it now. Good, we've got financing ways. And I would, if I was doing a lot of treatment plans, I would really work hard to get good financing for patients, and I would help take the risk. I would help self-fund it, you know, guarantee, if you like, the financier.
And there is a range of fantastic payment plan options out there nowadays where the patient pays zero interest and the dental practice does pay a percentage, 3%, 4%, 5%. When you take into consideration the percentage you lose anyway, if they paid on Amex or Visa or MasterCard, you lose percentage of that anyway. If you'd adopted that payment plan yourself, you would lose your staff member time and energy and the time that you could be earning interest on that money as well. So I think that 5%, 6%, 7% is
that's not nothing.
A big deal.
No.
That's right. I think that's fantastic. And they do take just about anybody on these plans, unless you're unemployed. But as long as you've got some sort of regular source of income, that's not to say that we should be putting people in a financial bind. But one of the things the patient's waiting for is, tell me how I'm financially better off spending this $20,000 with you.
Correct. And you need to understand ways, and I think that could be another coaching session, okay, to go through the financial elements of committing to a $20,000 treatment plan. I would do that. And one of the ways to do that is to say to the patient, this is what you need. And the patient says, look, I know I need it, but I can't afford it. And then respectfully, you say, well, how do you mean? Now, don't say why. Say, how do you mean? The why, I learned this a long time ago. When you say why to somebody, that forces them to justify. But when you say, what do you mean? Or how do you mean? You're seeking an explanation, not a justification.
Gotcha. That's good.
Okay. And so you say to person, when they say, I can't afford it, you say, how do you mean? Now, coming back to your confident communications, remember that at the back of your mind, you're worried about the fear of rejection, but you're enthusiastic about this plan. The only possible reason why the patient wouldn't do this is because they can't afford it or they don't understand it. We'll say, great, I'm going to explain it even more. If you're not enthusiastic about it, don't do it. We've already agreed on that. And so the patient, the benefit for the patient, you sit down and say, how do you mean? The patient says, well, I'm only earning $20,000 a year. And you say to them, do you realize that you could pay this off by paying $3 a day, right? Which is $20 a week, which is $1,000 a year. Or let's get a bit better. Let's get $5 a day, you know, $6 a day. So we're talking $2,000 a year. That's, you could have magnificent teeth, increase your income earning ability at the cost of 1.5 cups of coffee a day, or make it 2 cups of coffee a day. And they go, how do you, you know, and then they should say, how do you mean? Say, like this, this is what 2 cups of coffee a day will cost you. And I've worked this out for my daughter, by the way. Well, I said to her, if you buy 2 cup coffees a day at $4, it's $8 a day, 7 days a week, let's take 5 weekdays, that's $40 a week, it's $2,000 a year before tax, it's $3,000 a year of your income, just 2 coffees a day.
And so,
to develop your confident communication, you understand how to get inside the financial structure of the patient. Again, respectfully, and you say to them, well, if you gave up cigarette smoking, you could afford a $20,000 treatment plan. Now, that's an exciting idea. That might help the patient. That might help the patient give up smoking.
Yeah.
Now, there's another strategy that you can use, and that is to have for your practice a financial architect, not a financial planner, but to have a person who can work out, because most people don't have a budget. And so I reckon that thought has just occurred to me.
It's a really interesting thought, and financial knowledge around what practice payment plan do you offer and what external payment plans, finance plans do we offer. That's the limit usually of the practice facilitator or the dentist or the receptionist who's doing some of the discussion around treatment plans. But to actually have somebody whose area, she has part of her responsibilities and expertise in different finance options, different ways of discussing finance, different ways of
perceiving
value and cost.
And cash flow and to do a budget.
Yeah.
You see,
yeah.
So you get a bookkeeper to do this. You can have a close bookkeeper and say, look, I'll set up a time with our bookkeeper, they'll take you through the possible ways for you to afford this.
Yeah.
Does that sound reasonable? And they go, yeah, I'd like to do this.
And that's part of search and evaluation that comes prior to them being able to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so quite often I've seen in my time patients saying, I desperately want the treatment, I can't see how I can afford that.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to provide a solution or another discussion of helpful insights that will help that patient make that final decision around that.
Now, last two clues, because we're over time, almost over time. Your confidence will come from practice, these skills. So you have to make this decision to say, I'm not going to be perfect at this, but I will adopt this process and I will get better at it. Just like you learned about dentistry.
Yeah.
I was willing to start the learning process.
Mm.
Okay, so by following this process that we've talked about, writing out the script and practicing it, you are developing your skill to get better and better and better, to get better conversion of treatment plans about which you are enthusiastic. That's my rider in all of this. The next issue is, after each presentation of a treatment plan, ideally straight after, but by the end of the day, you should note what you did well and what you did not do well. Because that's called the deliberate learning. That's the other process, okay? We learn, but deliberate learning is an important principle I think, Julie, we should explore that in another club topic. Deliberate learning is when you identify, gosh, how did I go? And I would recommend videotaping it, and I would recommend getting feedback in the club sessions.
Yes.
Say, here's how it was, how could I make this better? But if you did 10 treatment plan presentations, 5 treatment plan presentations a week, and you found one thing you did well and one thing that you could improve, bang, after 6 months, just imagine how good you would get.
Glorious, and it lends itself so beautifully to the 10 culture that we really do promote, which is constant, never-ending improvement. And we've identified in past live sessions that an important element of constant and never-ending improvement is both practice and repetition, but also feedback, which is what the deliberate learning is all around. And that deliberate learning, if you consider that you had a receptionist that was great at all their bits and pieces, but she just wasn't good at following up on accounts. And if she said to you, I'm just no good at following up on accounts, so I'm just going to avoid that area, you would be like, no way, I can provide more training. I can provide support. We can get you there. There's somebody else you can talk to that can help you with it. And that's stuff that's great at it. And so as a dentist, to be able to look at that communication with patients and go, I'm just not that good at it, so I'm just going to avoid it. I'm going to resist it. It doesn't make sense. You are better off jumping on that wagon of constant and never-ending improvement, understanding that just like the feelings in your early days, you are quite comfortable recognizing, I know I feel incompetent now, but that will improve. I will become more and more competent through practice. You are accepting of that. That is the same with your treatment plan presentations as well, but also recognizing that value of feedback.
One other comment that I would urge. When a treatment plan is not accepted, do you know why it was not accepted? I suggest not. So, great question to ask. Ideally, you as a young dentist, you have the time. You ring the patient, not the receptionist. But if you haven't got time, you get the receptionist. But you ring the patient, when they say, no, I'm not going ahead with it, and you'll know very quickly whether or not. You ring up and you say to the patient, Mr. Patient, Miss Patient, I need your help. Now, psychologically, subconsciously, as human beings, we immediately say, yes, of course, how can I help the dentist? They go, me help you? I need your help. I need to understand what I did wrong so that you didn't go ahead with the treatment plan. That's all. Can you tell me what I did wrong that stopped you from going ahead with the treatment plan?
What didn't I explain effectively enough?
No, just keep it general. Because you don't want to go down a particular, because we don't know why the patient didn't. You know, and when you understand, you see, this also helps you face rejection. The patient might say, I hate your guts. Well, one of the ways to handle that is to think, what's the worst that can happen? And that's what I do when I'm nervous about doing something. I say, what's the worst? Well, they can abuse me and say, you are the worst dentist. I never want to go near you again, and I hate you. And you say, thank you very much. That's useful to know, because some people don't love you. You know, like, it's hard to imagine, but some people, not everyone loves us.
Yeah, for sure.
So finding out, so truly finding out as best you can, because that question afterwards, can you help me? You would be amazed. All sales statistics across all industries say this has a huge take up, because the patient says, oh, I didn't buy because it costs $4,000 a year. And you go, what? And by this follow up conversation, many of them can be converted back. So don't just give up because they've said no.
And I think that a thought that I had earlier when you were talking about part of it. Oh, that's right. When you were talking about our needs, wants, and it ties into that nice a little bit as well. We're in a lucky position in a dental environment where when patients come back to us, they return to us. Sometimes every 6 months, sometimes every time there's an emergency. But if they still maintain living in the area and they like your service adequately, they will become loyal in whatever term their loyalty means, you know, whether it be, but their frequency is another thing, but they're loyal to you. And so just like a little child who doesn't want to eat broccoli and you're trying to encourage that child why it's good to eat broccoli, you know you don't just have that one moment in time to try to get that child to say yes and become enthusiastic about the broccoli. Mm. You've got the next night dinner and the next night dinner, the next night dinner. And you've got that as well with your patients. You don't have just this one chance. You can continue having these discussions with the patient every time they come in more and more elegant ways, because in the meantime, you've developed better scripts and you've had more practice and you've become much more comfortable with the patient's possible negative reaction, what you've got to say. You're putting a different meaning on that. There's the 80-20 rule that I tend to put to everything. You are never going to have 100% of your patients smile broadly and thank you for all the information that you've had and then go in and book for all that treatment. Mm. You are going to have a percentage that say no, that reject you, and to go, that's fantastic, because that each rejection is another step closer to doing this better and to my next yes. And over time, my hit rate, if you like, will get better and better over time. So eventually my child will grow up eating broccoli, and eventually my patients will, majority, start saying yes to my next treatment.
And that's a good, interesting question. So obviously keep statistics, keep your own statistics if you want to get good at this. And I suggest this is a useful thing to get good at.
Absolutely. And if you don't keep your own statistics, progress is slow sometimes. And so you don't feel like you're getting better. Mm. But the bits on the paper will tell you, yes, you are getting better at. And as Anthony Robbins says, progress is such an important aspect to happiness in life. We need to feel like we're getting somewhere with our efforts.
And you didn't make mention of my red passion jacket.
The red passion jacket.
I hope some of you recognise it.
So passionate, Charles is Australasia's passion provocateur, as you know, and passionate red jacket is one of the things that he does to identify himself. And so having just done the podcast where he wears the red jacket every single time, why not wear it to the live session as well? Thank you very, very much.
Pleasure.
For your input. Sorry for the break in transmission. You'll get two recordings, as you all know by now. There haven't been any questions raised, so I'll sign off. I'll just share the screen again. We'll talk about what's happening next time. And for today, as you know, we click in, we tick off that we've done this today. We take the priority off and we tick off that we have had Charles present his brilliance. We'll drag that over to the completed column. And next time is Wednesday and we will be talking about incomplete treatment follow-up, moving to one session a week. We've got a couple of little housekeeping things as always to move through. But now that we're making the club an attractive and appealing for many people, and now that dental practices have come back, really back to normal productivity, a lot of members are going to be having trouble dedicating two separate 1 hours a week to these learnings. And so bringing it down to once a week, with the second weekly one being a bit of a catch-up for newer members coming on board, is probably a good way to go. We'll be presenting the new daily focus from Wednesday onwards, and I'll be talking about a discount code just for you members, because you've been here from the start, so you can enjoy the club at half price for another 3 months. So that's what's happening next week. Thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed it. And if you have any questions in the meantime for Charles or myself, please feel free to put them on the Facebook chat group or email us directly. Thanks. See you later.
Bye.